Okay, case 13 is submitted, and our second case of the morning is case number 29, June versus State. Counsel, please approach. Mr. Hessel, when you're ready.
May it please the court, Todd Hessel on behalf of petitioner Adam Jun, and I'm here with my colleague Eric Bakaj, who will be handling the rebuttal argument. Since this court's decision in Raglan, Maryland law has been clear that when a police officer, or any witness for that matter, gives testimony based on specialized knowledge, skill, experience, or training, that witness needs to be disclosed and qualified as an expert. Here, two foundational elements of the state's case against Mr. Jun were presented through a detective who, while testifying as a lay witness, drew upon his years of experience, specialized experience, as an internet crimes investigator to explain the significance of the evidence to the trial judge. Because that witness, that detective, was not disclosed or qualified as an expert, this court should reverse. First thing the detective did was he relied on his experience of having received 350 to 400 cyber tips during his years in the Internet Crimes Unit to educate the trial judge on the nature and significance of an IP address. Detective Bruce told the trial judge what an IP address is, in the detective's words, quote, an assigned internet protocol address that you get from an internet service provider so you could access the internet. And he explained the, quote, benefit, unquote, to his investigation in knowing this information, specifically the location where internet activity is coming from. The detective also expressly relied on, quote, my experience in handling these investigations, looking at the data that's provided, knowing what IP address is the most reliable one to be focusing on, to explain why he had singled out a particular IP address among the several that were on the NCMEC tip, and as support for his assertion that the IP address he identified had, quote, not changed, unquote, and was associated with a Wi-Fi connection and was a more reliable IPv4 IP address.
And that so, was- we're going to take these in seriatim. I have a question about that part, which is, why is that beyond the canon of an average layperson? I know, for example, anytime one of my kids logs into a Netflix account on a different address, I get an email saying there's been a new login at this IP address at this location. I imagine that I'm not alone in that. Why is that beyond the kind of the average layperson?
Well, because I think that the typical internet user's experience does not involve an IP address at all. You don't need to know it. You don't need to enter it. You never see it. So it's just not something that is associated with the common internet experience, that you have a particular number assigned to a specific physical location that's assigned by an internet service provider. In our view, that's just not something that's part of the common internet experience.
And is there any authority for that?
Yes, I think, we've cited several out-of-state cases in the briefs. There's a case from Colorado, a case from Pennsylvania, and so the relevant authority all holds that this is the subject of expert testimony.
I mean, just the basic knowledge that IP addresses exist and they identify locations where internet access occurs.
You're asking if that's what those cases hold?
No, I mean, I know what those cases hold,
right, right.
And I mean, obviously every case comes up in a specific context, but and this stuff changes all the time. Is there anything beyond those cases that just the basic notion that every device that accesses the internet has an IP address and it's tied to a specific location is beyond the ken of the average layperson, that people just don't understand that?
Well, I think, yeah, I would point to two things. One, you can look at the actual authority, the state sites, which consists of, one, references to commercial VPN sites, which in the state's words, it says, seeks to educate the public about IP addresses. And my response would be is if it's common knowledge, then why does the public need to be educated about what they are from these commercial VPN sites? And then if you look, the state also cites a Google help page, which says that an IP address is roughly correlated with geography. I mean, what does that mean? Is it a specific address, as the state said here? Is it a specific geographic region? So it's not clear. And I would also refer the court to the extent the trial judge in this case can be considered a sort of proxy for the average person. If you look at the motion in limine discussion, particularly on pages 57 through 58 of the extract, the trial judge is asking the prosecutor, well, what if I access through a laptop and I go to a different location? Does the IP address change? And the court literally said, I'm just trying to understand. So it's not clear that the trial judge understands exactly the nature of an IP address.
What about the standard in Galicia where the court said the question is not whether the average person is already knowledgeable? It sounds like that might have been the exchange that that defense counsel had with the trial judge at the motion in limine about a given subject, but whether it is within the range of perception and understanding of that average person. And it does appear here when you read the transcript or the record of the hearing that through the examination of the detective, it is within the range of understanding. You might not know necessarily what an IP address specifically is just because you get on the internet, but you can do a Google search and understand what it is.
Right. Well, my response to that would be you can do a Google search and understand what a lot of things are. And we wouldn't say because of that it's not expert testimony. I mean, the way I read that framing of the standards is it's really another way of asking what is common knowledge. And if you look at that part of the Galicia opinion immediately after that, the court says, well, even if you don't have personal experience toggling on and off location tracking software, people generally understand that this is a consumer feature and that you can customize the data that your phone collects about you. So I would really interpret that language as really just being a rephrasing of the common knowledge test. And I think it has to be that way because I don't think it can be the test that you look at the testimony and ask, well, if this is something that's comprehensible by a layperson, then an expert isn't required because the whole point of an expert is to explain something in the way a layperson can understand it. So you'd essentially be collapsing all expert testimony into lay testimony.
Well, I think many people might not know what Snapchat is because they don't use it. But if a 12-year-old said, well, it's a way that you communicate through an app and it allows you to transmit messages that disappear, do you really need an expert to tell you that information instead of a 12-year-old that can explain it to you that a layperson would understand?
Well, perhaps. I mean, the way I put it is where does that, what's the stopping point for that test, right? Because if someone comes in and gives if Neil deGrasse Tyson walks into the courtroom and gives an explanation of black holes that everyone can understand, well, we could look at it and say, well, that was comprehensible by a layperson. But of course, you wouldn't say that that no expert was required for that testimony. So I think you have to tether it back to what is common knowledge.
Wouldn't it depend, using Justice Booth's hypothetical, wouldn't it depend on what specifically was at issue relating to Snapchat? In other words, if a fact finder needs to understand the specific technology that Snapchat uses to make something disappear compared to another messaging system, maybe that would be different than just just the general idea that messages can disappear. Would you agree with that?
I think that's right, and I think that's the distinction in the case law. If you look, for example, at Johnson, it talks about devices that we're all familiar with, right? A witness can come in and read data from a clock, a thermometer, or a scale, or as in Johnson, a GPS device, because those are all devices that we're familiar with. The average person has an understanding of the reliability of those devices. So I think what the equivalent here, and this is actually some evidence of his issue in Galicia, would be like the results of a Google search. I mean, we're all familiar with doing Google searches, but here what the state was doing was explaining background technology behind the internet in order to pinpoint this activity to a specific location that was Mr. Jun's residential address. So
the state introduced evidence of the Verizon record showing that there's a particular location with a particular type of internet service and a particular IP address, and those are all business records. So what expert testimony is needed beyond that?
Well, I think the evidentiary significance of the record was not apparent on its face. Again, I think you needed the detective to explain the nature of IP addresses, and I think importantly that at least in his view, this particular IP address didn't change, because the court will see if you look at the subpoena for the Verizon information, it was for a very specific date and time. A discrete date and time. The transfers that were issued covered multiple days, and there was not a single one that aligned with that date and time for the Verizon request. So you had to understand that this IP address wouldn't change in order to associate that IP address with internet activity from that location for the period covering the charges. So I think it was quite significant, and that in rebutting the defense's argument that this Verizon information was limited to a specific point in time, the detective's testimony that this was a, quote, more reliable IP address that didn't change because it was an IPv4 address. And that's just not something, at least in our view, that the average person would know.
Well, can I ask, so are you saying that the records indicated whether it was a static IP address or a dynamic?
The records themselves did not.
They did not.
The detective testified to that.
And where did he obtain this information? Based on your argument,
not clear. And I think that's kind of our point. I mean, he's drawing on his experience as an internet crimes investigator. And that testimony that I'm referring to is at E458 of the extract.
What about the DHCP logs? Did the records indicate what whether these IP addresses were leased out, or how that explains how that works?
No, there was none of that. And I want to make sure I understand your question, Justin.
So, I mean, as I understand it, I'm no expert. But as I understand it, when a person there's a difference between a static IP address and a dynamic IP address, and a dynamic IP address, to the extent I understand it, indicates that changes at various times for any particular subscriber.
That's right, nothing in the records admitted into evidence indicated that. The Verizon record or the KIC records didn't indicate whether this was a static or a dynamic IP address.
So there would be a log, right? I guess, but my question is, there would be a log where as to when the IP address was assigned to someone else, to another subscriber. And my question to you is, does the documents, the business records, do they indicate a log, or when the defendant in this case, for example, when he was assigned this IP, this dynamic IP address?
No, they do not. All they indicate is that a specific time on April 20th, 2022, that this particular IP address was associated with an account that belonged to at Mr. Jun's residence. So it was the detective's testimony, and again, that goes back to the point I was making earlier, that, I mean, what the state could have done and what the what has happened in other cases is that you subpoena the IP records from the service provider for all the whole period covering the file transfers that are at issue. That's not what happened here. Again, they got it for a specific day and time that actually didn't align with any of the transfers for which Mr. Jun was charged and ultimately convicted. So that's why it was so significant that the detective testified that this was a static IP address that didn't change. I do want to get to the KIC records because that's the other major component of the state's case where the detective drew on his specialized experience to explain the evidence to the trial judge. So these were internal records that the state and the detective obtained by submitting a search warrant through a portal. In return, he got an encrypted zip file, which he unzipped to extract two folders, one a contents folder and the other a logs folder. The detective identified material, quote, relevant to the investigation, which included two text files, 34 chat platforms sent received, and 33 chat platforms sent, which for purposes of trial, the state reformatted into something more readable. Which, because as the employee for the state's attorney's office testified, these were, quote, sort of a jumbled up mess. The detective then used something called a production order results legend, which the detective described as something that showed him how to interpret the files. And based on that, he explained that 34 chat platforms sent received showed that Mr. Jun had received certain CSAM files over a period in April and May 2022. He then explained that 33 chat platforms sent showed that Mr. Jun had transmitted some of those same files during the same period, and that file transfer activity came from an IP address, quote, associated with this investigation, unquote, and that came back to a location in Anne Arundel County. And how do we know that the detective relied on his specialized experience to explain the data in the way I've just described? Well, again, he testified as much. When asked whether, so two of the entries in the data were user JID and related user JID, which the detective explained responded to file senders and recipients, respectively. And when asked if this was something that a layperson would know, he said, quote, if they don't do this work as often as I or my colleagues do, then they wouldn't understand, unquote, and, quote, they don't have the training, knowledge, or experience to know that. And that's at E-400. And again, the trial judge remarks indicated that this was expert testimony. The trial judge said, essentially likened this to translating a foreign language, said it was being somewhat akin to as if the detective could read and write French, but French was not his native language, and that's at E-22. And I think that's the correct analogy. Where the trial judge got it wrong was in his belief that an expert is not required to translate a foreign language, whether it's a foreign language or...
Didn't the legend basically take care of that, that came from KIC?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because for a few reasons. I mean, one, I don't think it was apparent from the legend what the data entries were. I mean, user JID is not sender. Related user JID is not recipient. So the detective, and he testified, he knew that from his experience. And I mean, if you look in the record extract at these files, I mean, these are not... something a consumer deals with every day. I mean, in Payne, the court talked about the cell phone records were not the equivalent of a phone bill that someone normally deals with. And I think it's the same thing here. And I'll also note that there were some entries in there that were never explained at all, like the timestamp, which is the first column in the records, and the native records themselves aren't even really organized into clear columns, which is why the state had to reformat them into demonstrative exhibits to make them more readable. it's not even clear what timestamp, which is the first entry in the records, is. I mean, there are separate categories for date and time, which the state relied on as showing the dates and times of the transfers at issue, but the timestamp was never explained. There's another category for app name that wasn't explained. So the
timestamp, it's hard to know what to make of that, but it, in the sent file, the user JID, you go down and it's all the same username. It's his, or the one that was attributed to him. And then the column next to it, the related user JID, is all different ones, sometimes the same, but you know, it's not the same all the way through. And in the receive file, it's the opposite. It's the AJ whatever all in one column as the and then all different in the other column. I guess my question is that so hard to figure out when the files are one sent and one received, what the relationship of those two columns is to each other?
Well, a couple points on that. I mean, one, the actual file, there was a discrepancy between what was in the legend and what the actual file names. One of the files says sent received in it, and the legend just has a file for sent and a file for received. So there's some ambiguity there. I think the way I would frame it is if this information were just to be submitted to a jury without any explanation, would the court be confident in saying, oh yeah, they would just figure it out? In my view, the answer to that question is no, and I think the record makes that apparent. Why did the state feel the need to reformat the data into something more readable? Why did the trial court say it was like translating a foreign language? Why did the...
Well, that's similar to the use of the summary exhibit rule. It's just so that the fact finder doesn't have to spend 5 weeks going through records if you can reformat it or provide a summary. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's beyond the ken of the average layperson.
Right, and maybe that alone is, but we're not exclusively relying on the reformatting. I mean, I think that's part of it. Again, I've already mentioned the detective saying that he knew what these columns meant based on his training and experience. So, and I know in Freeman, the court said, well, yeah, the officer said that, but this is like, you know, learning a slang term is part of the everyday experience of the average person. I just don't think...
But to the Chief Justice's point, if the detective receives records of this nature for the first time, and instead of saying, well, based upon my training, based upon my experience, I know what this means, he says, well, this is the first time I saw it, so I had to actually look at it, and I noticed these patterns, such as the ones that the chief pointed out, and this is the rational inference I'm drawing from my observation of these entries. In that instance, would you agree that would be proper lay testimony?
Right. I mean, if he's not relying on his experience, then yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, but there has to be a first time for reading these types of records, and if it's something that a person can look at and study long enough and detect and figure out these patterns without having a specialized training, why penalize the detective just because he's done it before and he doesn't have to undertake that effort for this particular case?
Well, I think that goes back to the core idea of what the rule is. I mean, if he understands what these records are because of his experience as a detective, which I think is the case here, then that's expert testimony. I mean, that's really the core rule. He's relying on his specialized experience to help the trier of fact understand the record. So he understands the record because he's seen them before during his time as an internet crimes investigator. He's drawing on that experience to help the fact finder understand the evidence. That's quintessential expert testimony.
Mr. Hazel, you can certainly keep going, but you are into your
remarks. No, I was going to stop. I'm sorry. I've already eaten into Mr. Bakaj's time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hessel. Ms. Chipper.
Good Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jillian Chipper on behalf of the state of Maryland. In April of 2022, petitioner Adam Jun utilized his home internet service and the social media application Kik to access, possess, and distribute child sexual abuse material. After a bench trial in the Anne Arundel County Circuit Court, he was convicted of those crimes. The question in this case before this court is whether the trial court properly allowed lay testimony from the state's primary detective, Detective Bruce, about two aspects of this case. First, the fact that electronic devices access the internet via an IP address, which could be tied to a physical location. Second, the meaning of the certified Kik records that showed that Mr. Jun had exchanged child sexual abuse material with other Kik users. Because Mr. Jun has failed to establish that the trial court abused its discretion by admitting Detective Bruce's testimony on either of these subjects, this court should affirm Mr. Jun's convictions. I'll turn first to talk about the first issue, which is the testimony related to the IP address that Mr. Jun was utilizing when he accessed these files. And I do think that it helps to ground this discussion in what this court's standard is for the requirement for expert testimony and the difference between expert testimony and lay testimony. And what this court has said very recently is that a witness needs to be qualified as an expert when the subject of their testimony is so beyond the ken of an average layperson that it's not within their understanding. But what this court has said is that the standard doesn't demand that the fact finder already be knowledgeable about the subject of the testimony, but only that it's within the person's range of perception and understanding. And I do theoretically understand Mr. Hessel's point that standard doesn't mean after the explanation of an expert about the technology underlying something. There is a certain stopping point that expert testimony becomes necessary. But what that standard means is that even if a layperson doesn't know that internet service is tied to a physical location by an IP address, which is a string of numbers, once they are alerted to that fact, they can understand it, and they can understand its significance as it relates to this case based on their common sense and life experience. And so
I wanted to Justice Biron asked Mr. Hessel about Snapchat and suggested mm-hmm. that the real test is what you're asking about Snapchat. Mm-hmm. Do you accept that premise that expert testimony wouldn't necessarily be necessary for every single question about Snapchat, but it would, depending on what you're asking?
I accept that premise, yes.
Okay, so with respect to IP addresses, there are a lot of different things that go on. Certainly when you're talking about static IP addresses, you have one tied to a specific Wi-Fi router, and everything that goes through it has that. But you also have other things going on that are in the record here, like dynamic IP addresses perform differently, and you have VPNs, which mask IP addresses, and there are other things going on. Why, with respect to the testimony that this detective gave about IP addresses, does it fall on the side that it's okay on and not on the side that it would require some more expert knowledge?
Because in this case, in response to the state's questions and the information that the state relied on in this case, that Detective Bruce testified to, were simple and common understanding of IP addresses, that they tie internet activity to a physical location, and that records of these things are kept by internet service providers. On the issue of static versus dynamic IP addresses and IPv4s versus IPv6s, preliminarily, the state did not rely on that level of detail about what IP addresses are in its case. That testimony came in response to cross-examination by Mr. Jun. And the detective, when he testified, the prosecutor, on direct examination, the prosecutor essentially asked him, what was the IP address in this case? The detective gave the string of numbers that made up the IP address in this case and simply said, which is an IPv4 IP address. The state did not elaborate on that. It wasn't directly in response to the state's question, and it wasn't important to the state's case or relied on by the state at all. Then on cross-examination is where we get the more detailed testimony about IPv4 versus 6 and static versus dynamic. And so while the state certainly acknowledges that defense attorneys don't need to ignore what they have perceived to be objectionable testimony on cross-examination to retain their appeal right on that information, what happened here is different than that, because looking at this court's decision in Galicia, the question was whether it was within the ken of the average layperson to understand that a cell phone and a smartphone user can toggle location data on and off. And the court was very clear that part of its decision-making progress was that the testimony and the utility of the information that the state elicited in that case was the ability to do it, not the technology that underlied it. And so in Galicia, it would not have been proper for the defense attorney to then cross-examine the witness on the technology that underlied that ability to toggle on and off, and then argue that it was on that basis that that witness needed to be qualified as an expert. And so the same thing is at play here. The
except that the information could be exonerated. Right? I mean, if the theory of the case, I mean, not this particular case perhaps, but in other cases, it could be exonerating evidence. And the court's not going to bring this up in its direct. And the defense cross-examines on this potentially exonerating evidence. And in this case, Detective Bruce, I don't believe had any, unless you tell me otherwise, he didn't have any foundational expertise on DHCP leasing or static versus dynamic assignments or anything like that. So, why is that fair to the defense?
Why is that what?
Why is that fair to the defense?
Well, I think that Your Honor's question, I mean, there are always competing interests when you are representing a party and advancing a theory of a case. And if that sort of information is going to be exonerating in some case, then perhaps it's worth raising. But in this case, and it brings me to my next point on this particular evidence, the IPv4 and static versus dynamic. In this case, the purpose of that testimony at best would have been to suggest or to prove that the IP address did not change. It continued to be assigned to Mr. Jun during the relevant periods in this case. And that was amply proven by the substance of the KIC record. So it really wasn't up for debate, because what we see from the KIC records is that it continues to be the same IP address accessing, sending, and receiving files via Mr. Jun's KIC account, the AJ184 series of numbers KIC account. And what we see in those files for the relevant time period to these charges are files being sent by that account that only Mr. Jun could have had access to.
Have you shifted now to a harmless error? Yeah. Is that the import of this argument?
I think that goes toward, if this court were to determine that the IPv4 versus 6 and the static versus dynamic testimony, first of all, wasn't invited error, and second of all, had sort of crossed the line over into expert testimony, which I'm not conceding that it did. Static means that it stays the same, and dynamic means that it changes. Those are terms that average lay people can understand. But to the extent that the court gets that far on this topic, that testimony was particularly harmless because of how amply the Mr. Jones continued tied to that IP address was through the substance of the KIC records.
How would this be invited error?
Because it was only raised on cross-examination.
But maybe this is just asking Justice Kilo's question in a different way. And if the defense's position were, in order to meet the state's burden in terms of a sufficiency analysis, they need to prove that this was a static versus a dynamic address, and the state didn't, in the defense's view, meet that burden, the defense wouldn't just have to just rely on a motion at the conclusion of the state's case and say, well, you didn't meet your burden. They could probe that on cross to help establish that, couldn't they?
Well, I understand Your Honor's point, but that's not what the defense was trying to do in this case. What the defense was trying to do through that cross-examination was to point out all of the things that they perceived Detective Bruce to not know about IP addresses, or sort of the limit of Detective Bruce's understanding of IP addresses. And so that testimony—
And they were successful in some respects, weren't they? I mean, he was acquitted on some of the charges relating to, the trial judge's—
He was acquitted on the charges that pertained to May 2nd, but that wasn't as a result of the trial court's
right, but it had to relate
rejection.
Relate to questions that the defense raised during cross-examination regarding the different IP addresses and whether it was dynamic or static and arguments along those lines.
My understanding is not that the acquittals on those counts had to do with Detective Bruce's explanation of what was going on with the IP addresses. My understanding is that those acquittals had to do with the fact that the log that logged the IP addresses simply didn't have entries for May 2nd, which was a different document that was introduced by the defense.
I think I'm saying the same thing, I hope, but maybe not. But it related to the challenges that the defense raised regarding the documents, the business records supplied in the case. And the defense, by cross-examining on certain points, such as these log dates don't match up. And that judge, the trier of fact in that case, found that at least enough to acquit the defendant on those charges.
That's true, but the... You know, when we're talking about the cross-examination of Detective Bruce, what I'm talking about is sort of a very discreet line of questioning about the IPv4.
Right, we're also talking about an overall principle. I mean, mm-hmm. How do we treat this information? Do we need someone to come in and testify? I mean, if for example, there's a crime at a location that says, AirPods, and the suspect's phone is retrieved, and it says, "Find my device," and they find an iPod at 123 Main Street at 3:12 p.m. Mm-hmm. And we know that the crime allegedly occurred around 4:00. Well, the state, can the detective just read, on the suspect's phone that said, "Find my device"? And it said it was the AirPods. His AirPods were at 123 Main Street at 3:12 p.m. Wouldn't the trier of fact need to know that? Well, that's the last time maybe that the signal was sent to the Apple server, or maybe that was the last time that it left that location at 4:00 was somewhere else. I mean, wouldn't there be more information needed so that you could present a fuller case to the to a jury, and that an expert can explain that?
Well, I mean, in Galicia, this court noted that a cell phone's identification of its location is one of its essential virtues. And so in Your Honor's hypothetical, I don't think that expert testimony would be necessary because I think that the common person understands that that your location is known when you have a cell phone on your person, and certainly could understand. You know, this is a good example of not every cell phone user or smartphone user has a pair of AirPods, but every
AirPods.
But every the common person understands that they connect via Bluetooth to your smartphone, and that you can find them using your phone.
It's my favorite feature.
Well, it makes it easier to find them for sure. We've spent a lot of time talking about this very specific portion of the detective's testimony. And, you know, of course it came in on cross-examination, but how that is especially important is that the state was able to make the link that it wanted to make and that it needed to make to convict Mr. Jun in this case based on the much simpler fact, which is that internet activity is tied to a physical location versus via an IP address. And while the average layperson may or may not know that fact at the outset, when the average layperson hears that fact, he or she can understand and perceive it based on their common sense and their common life experience. So things like I discussed in my brief where, you know, when you get on the internet and you search for the best Italian restaurant, it doesn't give you, you know, sitting in Annapolis, Maryland, it doesn't give you an Italian restaurant in Denmark. It gives you an Italian restaurant down the street from you. And so
that's if you let it use your location, right?
And if you're not on a VPN.
Ms. Chipper, I have a question just on the record. I understand that the Verizon subpoena went for one day for the IP address. But the KIC records, I didn't see the warrant in the record extract. But on the return and the business record, it appears that it was tied to 30 days of an IP address. So in other words, when the state is seeking the records from KIC, they're using that IP address. That's the 30 days that they're tying that IP address to those records.
Okay.
I'm asking, is that in the record? In other words, looking at the legend from KIC, it says EDR return results contain subscriber data, PDF, last 30 days of IP addresses. Mm-hmm. So it appears that when the warrant was sent to KIC, it was based on the IP address contained in the Verizon records.
Yes, I agree with that. I can't say for certain that I've laid my eyes on exactly what the warrant says, okay. But that's my understanding of how, you know, and I think that's raises another good point, which is that the IP address that Mr. Jun was utilizing was, once the detectives knew that IP address, they were able to subpoena these KIC records for that IP address. And then once the KIC records were available for the detectives to review, it was very obvious that Mr. Jun was the person utilizing that IP address and was the person sending and receiving, or certainly sending, the files that were associated with this KIC username. And so unless there are any other questions specifically about the IP address portion, I'll turn to the KIC records while I still have enough time to talk about them. So these KIC records were, Mr. Jun's argument as it relates to these KIC records really boils down to the question of whether Detective Bruce could make the inference that in these files the user was the sender. The user was the sender, and the related user was the recipient of these files. And this was simply a common sense reading of the records. And not only is it a common sense reading generally, we know from the record that it was the trial court's common sense reading of these records as well. And he was the finder of fact in this case. When the detective was initially testifying about, user meaning sender and related user meaning recipient, there was obviously an objection to that. And what the trial court said at that point was that though it liked to stay as close to the actual language in the records as possible, it could recognize in common language that sometimes we say senders and recipients, and that this was common knowledge in society. And that's at E235 to 236. And so what the trial court didn't say was, now that Detective Bruce has explained it to me, I understand that this means user or sender and recipient. What he said was that I recognize in common language that's what we would say. And so Detective Bruce, the kick legend in this case was admitted as an exhibit. It was in the trial record as State's Exhibit 1, and it explained what these records were. It explained, first of all, Mr. Jun has sort of labeled these, and I think the state's witness did say that they were a bit of a jumbled mess. Well, the kick legend explains at the top of the second page, which is E677. The logs folder will contain several different files. Each one contains a different set of data with different headers. We have outlined them below as they are not auto-generated during production process. So what the kick legend is explicitly explaining, we understand that there are no headers in these documents, and we've explained that just doesn't happen via auto-generation, and so here are what the headers should be. And so while this aspect of this case is very much like the issue that this court, or at least the analysis this court employed in Freeman, because while Detective Bruce testified that he knew how to look at these records because of his experience in the Internet Crimes Against Children unit, when we look at it in context, what he meant was that he knows how to look at them because he's looked at them before. He knows how to review them because he's reviewed them before.
But that's a forensic examination, isn't it? That's just not an administrative one. He's looking at these records forensically. It requires some background. You just said it yourself. For him to interpret them, it requires some background information on what the records mean.
Well, it doesn't. There's no background information besides what the records themselves say. So there's the record, and I think that this is where some of the analogy to pain sort of crumbles at this point, because in this case, the legend is part of the records. There are the logs and there's the legend, and that's all as a total the records that make up this case, whereas in Payne we were talking about there were instructions that the detective followed to analyze the records in Payne, but they were not part of the record. They did not come as part of the records, the business records in that case, and it was somewhat opaque. The detective in that case also had to make the choice, based on his training and experience, to apply those instructions to the records in Payne. Whereas here, the records themselves consist of both the logs and the legend in this case. And so when we're talking about how Detective Bruce got to being able to review these records, we're thinking about the process that he undertook to be able to do that. Just like in Freeman, the process that the detective had to undertake to go from not knowing what the term LIC meant to knowing what the term LIC meant, even though He did that in the course of being a detective in the robbery unit and probably, you know, hearing defendants or victims use the term or reading text messages using the term. The process that he undertook, the language acquisition process, was not one that was beyond the ken of the average layperson. And so too here, Detective Bruce didn't say, well, I know that user means sender and related user means recipient because I attended a 10-day course put on by experts at KIC, and they explained to me that that's what this meant. He said, I look at the legend and I look at the logs, and I do this in the course of my job, but the process that he went from not knowing what they said to knowing what they said was a process that any layperson can undertake, just like the detective in Freeman.
Ms. Chipper?
Yes.
The standard that we've been discussing, whether this information is within the range of perception and understanding of a layperson, is it the same where there's a bench trial with a judge or jury, or is it a different standard? And the reason that I'm asking is because in the case law, Galicia and Payne, there's language, I think, that defines what that standard is, and that language refers to expert testimony providing information, relevant information, when the trier of fact would not otherwise be able to reach a rational conclusion. Such information is not likely to be part of the background knowledge of the judge or jurors themselves. And I see that language as defining the range of perception test. So is it the same for the judge and the jury?
I think that it is, Your Honor, but I think that here, the difference is that when we're talking about a jury, we really don't have any way of looking into the jurors' minds. And in a bench trial, it's a little bit different because we have comments that the trial court has made throughout the case. And what we have here is, you know, I've referenced it before, but, you know, there are two statements that the trial court in this case made that I think are important that lead to the conclusion that the trial court in this case, A, understood that the standard was what an average layperson could understand about this evidence, and that he did. Because, you know, when the detective was initially testifying about the meaning of user and related user, again, he said that the trial court said that he recognized that in common language that's user and or sender and recipient. And he also said, the trial court also said before it retired to render its verdict, or to deliberate, or to, which happened over the course of a break, but he said that he understood that this case turned on what an average person could understand about the records, could understand from the records. And so he said that if an average person could understand them, that favored the state. And if an average person couldn't understand them, that favored Mr. Jun. And he specifically and explicitly articulated that, and then he convicted Mr. Jun of most of the charges that he faced. My question is,
with a bench trial, are we thinking or looking at the average judge or, you know, an average member of the judiciary, or are we still with the average layperson?
The bench trial, we can look to the average judge because that's the fact finder in a bench trial. We're talking about the average fact finder, and in a bench trial, that is a judge, and in a jury trial, that is, you know, 12 members of a jury. And so I I do think that there is a bit of a distinction of what we can expect, generally speaking, an average judge to know versus an average juror to know. But I don't think that the that the outcome of this case is necessarily dependent on that. I see that I'm out of time, unless there are any questions.
Good question. Do you think this trial judge, next time he has a case involving these exact records, will need Detective Bruce to explain these records?
No.
Thanks. I see no other questions, so thank you, Ms. Chipper. And Mr. Bakaj, you have the slightly under 7 minutes reserved for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, and may it please the court. The convictions in this case rest on the conclusion that the user's IP address did not change between the time that was reflected in the Verizon records and the times that these file transfers occurred and resulted in the conviction. That information, that the IP address never changed, was not in the Verizon record, that was not in the, in fact, the KIC records indicate, as I'm sure the justices are aware, that numerous IP addresses appeared in the KIC logs. And
well, here's my question. So you have the business records under the Verizon that establish the IP address for that physical location. Then you have the business records presented by KIC and the legend and the part of the kind of the explanation, if you will, which was admitted as part of the business record, says it's for a 30-day period tied to an IP address. And you look at the last page of the KIC records, and it identifies this IP address as being that IP address. So can't you infer from these business records that that is the IP address for that account, and based on the fact that there was a search warrant for 30 days of records tied to an IP address, and those business records show that it's, in fact, that IP address, can't we kind of infer that it didn't change and you didn't need testimony about whether it's static because those business records reflect that fact?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's exactly the danger of admitting lay testimony for an area suited for an expert.
Well, these were business records that were admitted. So without even the detective testifying, you can read these business records and figure out what the IP address was for that location.
Well, I very respectfully, I have to push back on that because in my review and my understanding of what those, I think you're referring to the records from KIC, it has a log of 30 days and it includes numerous IP addresses that are associated with the account over that time. It doesn't suggest that there's simply a single IP address that was used to access that account.
And just to be clear, I'm looking at the page that shows, not when you get into the individual entries,
right,
but the date, let's see.
Extract page number?
Yes. What's the extract page number? It's 111, but I can't tell if that's
E680.
Oh, yes. E680 is where it starts. And so you have the information generally related to this account. The date on the top of that is July 7th. And it gives a whole bunch of information related to this profile. And on the last line of that, which I think is 680 or 681, it gives the static IP address for that particular account. So I'm not looking at necessarily all of those individual entries, but the information tied to this specific address.
Yes, Your Honor, and my understanding is that was the last IP address with which this user logged in on May 9th of 2022. Because if you then look, so just as another example, there were discrepancies in the KIC IP history log, which reflected all the different IP addresses that had been associated with this particular particular account. Those discrepancies led, as I recall, based on the comments of the judge, directly to the acquittals in counts 1, 2, 7, and 8 in this case, because there was an unexplained gap in the records showing the history of access to the account, which was not addressed by the legend that accompanied the KIC records.
You say discrepancies. My understanding is this is a Samsung mobile device?
That's what the records indicate, yes.
Right, so it would access from a different IP address depending on where it was, through the Wi-Fi router addressed to that home if it were in the home, through the mobile technology if it were elsewhere, through a different Wi-Fi router if it were somewhere with another Wi-Fi router that it was connected to, right?
I suppose that would be the case, but I couldn't tell you definitively that I know that. What I would suggest to Your Honor is that this that conclusion is exactly the sort of conclusion that we would need an expert to testify to. It's very similar to the tracing the communication path of a cell phone that this court considered in Payne. Even driving to the court this morning, I couldn't help but notice the cell phone towers on the side of the highway. And I know that my phone somehow connects to these, and you can probably figure out my location that way and perhaps my IP address. But even though that's a common experience that certainly all of us have in knowing that our phones are connecting and that somehow you can get our location, this court has required an expert to explain in a reliable way so that we're not guessing.
So are you saying that these business records may be admissible, that they're authentic, they're not hearsay, but they don't speak for themselves?
I think you need some,
it doesn't explain the technical information in there. It doesn't explain any discrepancies that might be in the data that requires expert testimony.
That's exactly right. I think that they're otherwise admissible and authentic, but their relevance in this case, they lose their relevance when they don't have an expert to explain how a fact finder can rely on an IP address for a date and time, a specific second, that doesn't correspond to the file transfers for which Mr. Jun was convicted. And, this Detective Bruce requested the subpoena from Verizon on the same day that he requested the search warrant from KIC. The state in this case should not receive the benefit of the doubt in evaluating this testimony when they could just as easily, we wouldn't even be having this conversation if the Verizon records were requested for the entire date of, for the entire time period instead of just that one moment. And for all of these reasons, Your Honor, I see my time has concluded. We would respectfully ask that this court reverse the decision of the lower courts. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both for your arguments. Case 29 has been submitted. For everybody's information, there was a problem with the live stream feed during this. If you had people back home who were watching, they may have been cut off. The audio continued to record, and that certainly will be available for everybody. And with that, the court stands adjourned until 9 o'clock in the morning on January 5th.
All right.
Don't stay on that.